On this episode of Padres Corner, these may be your next cancer detector. Clean coal takes a big step forward in Texas. I'm feeling a Comcastic rant. And Becky Worley comes on to tell us how to become a goddess of tech. Padres Corner is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Padres Corner is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Padres Corner, Episode 6, recorded September 16th, 2014. Becky Worley, mahalo for your aloha. Welcome to Padres Corner. I'm Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit. Padres Corner is our playground. It's our place to play where geeks and gals can gather to talk about the stories, the issues, and the tech that falls through the cracks. A while back, Lisa and Leo got together and said, you know what? All of our shows are bound to a particular topic. They're all bound to a particular theme. What if we were to have a show that had none of those, that could talk about whatever they wanted to talk about, that could play with whatever they wanted to play with, and could show off the gear, the tech, and the issues that they wanted to show off? Well, that's, my friends, what Padres Corner is all about. So let's get right to it. As we are off to do, I'd like to start off with some freaking science. This bit of freaking science comes to us from, a researcher in London who has come up with a very interesting idea. Now, today, if we want to get diagnosed, we can surround ourselves with the most advanced diagnostic equipment known to man. We have sensors that can measure body temperature, pulse rate, and organ function down to the last centigrade, heartbeat, and O2 level. We have machines that can look into the body, into the brain, the heart, the lungs, the liver, the organs, and see exactly what's going on without as much as a scalpel. And we have doctors who are trained to interpret all of the information that they get back from that equipment to give you the diagnosis about what might be wrong with your body. Well, that's all well and good, but that's millions and millions of dollars worth of gear and training and man hours that go into that diagnosis. What if there was something simpler? Well, folks, there is. But in the future, your diagnosis may need a box of bees. That's right. The lecturer at South Bank University in London has suggested that maybe, just maybe, there's a novel approach to diagnosis that involves a bunch of trained bees, an attractive glass bowl, and your breath. Susanna Soares has been working on the technology-biology interface for years and is trying to take advantage of a special talent that bees have, most notably their sense of smell. Now, bees have a sense of smell that is thousands, if not tens of thousands of times more sensitive than a trained scent dog. They have evolved to be able to detect pheromones. That's how they get around. That's how they communicate in a colony. And in fact, while a scent dog can detect particles in the parts per million, a bee can detect particles in parts per trillion. That's how sensitive their sense of smell has evolved. Now, here's how it works. First, the bees are trained to fly upwards towards a particular chemical scent. Different diseases add different unique chemical tagants to human breath. Now, Soares has shown that basic Pavlovian techniques can be used to train bees in less than 10 minutes. Now, second, the bees are put into a specially designed glass bowl. It has a stem and a chamber into which the patient can blow, and a larger area where the bees are stored. The patient blows into the stem, and if the bees detect a chemical tagant that they've been trained to find, they'll fly into the chamber, and the patient's breath will be positive for that particular ailment. Now, there's a lot of things to work out. This seems a little strange, and I'm sure not every doctor's office is going to be equipped with its own beehive. But the idea of taking a simpler route to give us an easier diagnosis that doesn't require all the gear, all the training, but rather relies on something that has developed in nature over millions, if not billions of years, well, that's some freaking science. Let's move on. This next little bit of engineering is a little bit different. I know it's going to get some people up in arms, but hear me out. Follow me through. Coal is dirty. We know that. But a lot of the power of this world is still generated by burning coal. Specifically, there's a plant in Texas that has been marked as one of the dirtiest in the country, if not in the world. 2 years ago, this NRG Parish Power Plant in Fort Bedford, just outside of Houston, was picked as the dirtiest coal system in the world. Now, the plant burns 36,000 tons of coal a day. Now, the burning of that coal releases tons of carbon dioxide and an unacceptable level of particulates. So they decided to go with a solution. Bury it. Now, last year, NRG started construction of a carbon capture system. The system consists of a series of pipes, flues, and sprayers. The exhaust from the coal-burning power unit will be routed through the flues and sprayed by a chemical solvent that captures the CO2 from the exhaust, and it also knocks down the particulates. The recovered solvent is recovered, piped to a distiller where the CO2 is separated from the solvent. Then the solvent is reused while the CO2 is compressed, cooled, and liquefied. Now, 1,000 liters of gas compresses to just over 2.5 liters of liquid CO2. So there's a huge benefit to this. There's a lot of storage space that you can get by turning it into a super cooled liquid. Now, once it is a liquid, the liquid CO2 will be pumped to the Rest Ranch oil field, which is about 80 miles southeast of the refinery. There, it will be pumped about a mile underground into older oil wells. The CO2 will increase the pressure in the wells, which allows them to extract more of the oil from those wells, which is very important if you've got an older well. So the pollution from burning CO2 will be used to, from burning fossil fuels, will actually be used to extract more fossil fuels. Now, there is still a huge question mark on whether or not this is a good thing to do. There have been several reports about how this exact type of process, which has been used for decades, actually since the late 70s, could be causing some groundwater contamination, could be causing earthquakes as you pressurize. There's also a big question for just people thinking about how long can you store millions and millions and millions of liters of CO2 under the earth in pressurized conditions, even if it's a mile underground, in a container that's not designed to be pressurized. However, the way I look at it is this. It may be dirty. It may be dangerous. However, unless we're willing to make a major investment towards nuclear power or renewables, this is pretty much all we can do, especially if you look at the online nature of the world and the coming online nature of China. Our thirst for power is only going to grow, and unfortunately, this is one of the only technologies that we have. So, nuclear, renewable, or a big bubble of CO2 under your feet. Now, when we come back, I do feel a rant coming on. In fact, I think this is feeling kind of Comcastic. But before that, I wanted to talk a little bit about a little something-something that I've been playing with. It's going to be in the tech. Not too long ago, I got to play with a brand new Toshiba Tekra W50-A1501. Interesting notebook, a little bit on the high on the price point. I wasn't so thrilled by the construction, but it was a very high-powered desktop replacement with a 4K screen. One of the curious things about this notebook was the fact that they decided to use a hard drive. That's right, not an SSD, not a hybrid, but a hard drive, a spinning hard drive. And that really kind of crippled the notebook. Even with all of the features, even with all this crazy fast, powerful GPU and a quad-core CPU, that hard drive knocked the PC Mark and 3D Mark score down to about 9967. Not great, especially for a notebook of that price. Well, after the review, I did have to give it a don't buy. I came back, and on know-how, I talked about maybe we could upgrade the hard disk drive to a solid-state drive to see exactly how much performance Toshiba was missing out on by putting a hard disk drive. So let's take a look in the tech to see what an SSD could do for you. For our upgrade, I chose the Kingston KC300 upgrade kit. It's not the fastest SSD on the market or in Kingston's arsenal of SSDs, but it has a high price-performance ratio and is my personal favorite in terms of reliability and performance over time. In upgrading the hard drive of a computer to an SSD, many kits, like the Kingston KC300, includes gear that allows you to clone the drive using the previous installation copied to the SSD, complete with your data, programming, and settings. While it's a tempting solution, I don't recommend it. A fresh, lean operating system is the way to go. Why spoil a new, crazy-fast piece of hardware with an installation that may be crapified? The first step is to make Restore Media for your operating system if you don't already have it. Many laptops, especially Windows 7 laptops, do not come with Restore Media, but instead have an application that allows you to create them as needed. In our case, the Toshiba Tekra W50 requires 4 DVD-Rs for the full set. Luckily, the W50 has an internal optical drive to burn those DVDs, but if you have a laptop without an optical drive, you'll need an external drive to complete the Restore set or, as is the case with many Windows 8 laptops, a USB drive large enough to contain the entire Restore image. With the Restore Media on hand, shut everything down and pull your old drive, replacing it with your SSD of choice. Here's where the upgrade kit comes in handy, even if you're not going to clone your old drive. The Kingston KC300 includes a USB 3.0 enclosure, originally intended to allow you to clone the SSD before installation. This enclosure doubles as a permanent case for your old hard disk drive, allowing you to retrieve your files after the upgrade. After the reinstallation of the OS and our benchmarking tool, PCMark Vantage, it's time to see what kind of performance boost we can get from our Tekra. The stock Toshiba Tekra W50 with its 500GB 5400RPM hard drive scored 9,967 on PCMark Vantage. With the Kingston KC300 upgrade, but everything else exactly the same, including the operating system, the W50 scored 24,262. The price of a Toshiba Tekra W50? $2,250. Price of a 240GB Kingston KC300 SSD kit? $110. Boosting the performance of your laptop a whopping 243% in an hour? Priceless. So if you're thinking about building yourself a system, don't even for a moment consider using a spinning drive as your operating system drive. It just doesn't make sense. In this particular example, it just baffled me because with a price of $2,250 for the base drive, it was only about, for the base unit, it was only about $60 more to get that SSD, which means that for about a 3% price savings, they chopped over 59% of their performance off the top. That's just not acceptable in this day and age, especially if you're going to pay that much for a laptop. Now let's move away from laptops. Let's talk about a little something that's getting me upset. Over the past couple of episodes, I know that I've talked about the cable industry a lot. I've talked about ISPs. I've talked about telcos. And I planned to stop. I really wanted to stop. But every time I get out, they drag me back in. This time, it's about something that's happening because of a campaign that the NCTA, that's the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, has been mounting over the past few weeks. They've been getting an army of lobbyists up to combat what they think is a major perception problem about their industry. You've probably seen them. If you've been on social media, especially Twitter, you've probably seen these sponsored tweets. Things like this saying, the NCTA cable industry wants to show you what overregulation can do. They're essentially trying to scare people into saying, hey, the government's coming in. They're trying to play themselves off as the victim of government heavy-handedness. They're trying to convince us that the NCTA is, well, they've seen all wrong. They are the ones who are being persecuted. They're trying to hit social media hard and give us the message that net neutrality will destroy the internet. Well, it really is no accident that this campaign is happening now because there is a major push. If you look through the NCTA's information, through the brochures, through the site that they've created specifically to tell us that these regulations are outdated, you see two things. First is that yesterday was the end of the second round of the request for comment by the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Their proposal for net neutrality, the one that created fast lanes, had its second round of comments. And just like the first, they were scathing. People responded in the millions to say, this is not the net that we want. This is not the job we ask you to do. This is not why you're our representatives. Stop this. But the second thing, and I think this is actually more important, this is they may have already accepted that they're not going to get this particular fast lane net neutrality guideline into place. But now they're going after the merger of Time Warner and Comcast, and they're doing it in a big way. Now, the FCC's net neutrality plan has been panned by the public, by tech insiders and the like, but the merger is still very much possible. It's still very much in the air, and the industry is putting their biggest guns in front. Now, what have they done? Of course, they've done this social media campaign. They've gotten the word out. They're trying to get on Facebook, on Twitter, wherever we live, and try to convince us, at least a few of us, that they really have our best interest at heart. Now, to back that up, they've been parading out politicians and state officials, over 70 mayors and additional state officials who say that the merger would benefit their cities and states. They're taking people out who say that, look, having this merger is going to narrow the digital divide. They've even recruited star power. That's right. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, former congressman and White House chief of staff, wrote a letter to the FCC saying how beneficial and generous Comcast has been to Chicago, and that, in fact, he's sure that they're going to be just as magnanimous to the rest of the country. Well, of course, that's all perfectly legit. That's all perfectly reasonable. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing illegal. There's actually nothing improper. Comcast is a business. Comcast is a corporation, and a corporation will do what a corporation does, and that is make money. Of course, they're going to put their best foot forward. Of course, they're going to bring out their biggest supporters. Of course, they're going to focus on the fact that their presence in certain cities has been a positive effect. And of course, they're going to say that they bridge the digital divide. Those are all the buzzwords that they're supposed to hit. But it's not the legality I'm worried about. It's the ethical implications of what's been going on behind the scenes. Quite specifically, they're buying our politicians. Comcast and Time Warner paid more than $100,000 for Rahm Emanuel's various re-election campaigns. That includes $15,000 directly from Comcast vice president and chief merger lobbyist Cohen. It includes $50,000 for Comcast employees since 2010, and it includes more than $46,000 from Comcast for his congressional campaigns. Comcast and Time Warner have also gone straight after the commissioner of the SEC. This one was really, really strange. It's almost as if they expected that this was going to go unnoticed, but they paid, combined, more than $100,000 to honor an FCC commissioner who is actually going to vote on the merger. That's right. They shelled out $132,000 to give FCC Commissioner Mignon Clyburn the Walter Cates Foundation's Diversity Advocate Award. Now, that award is actually just a sponsored prize, $110,000 from Comcast and $22,000 for Time Warner. Now, what about their so-called attempt to bridge the digital divide? I mean, that one's real, right? I mean, they're getting out there. They're making sure that service goes to the poor, goes to the communities that are underserved. Well, no. I mean, they are doing something with the digital divide, but they're not using it to bridge the gap. They're using it to widen it. Recently, there was an article in Ars Technica about how CenturyLink, a major ISP that's providing DSL across the country, has been complaining that Comcast has been aggressively using their digital divide campaign to keep CenturyLink from rolling out their new services. CenturyLink has a new service called GFast, which, if you're close enough to a DSL switch, will give you up to gigabit speeds with the existing lines. Well, the problem is that doesn't work everywhere in the city. I mean, you're going to have to upgrade major parts of the infrastructure in order to give GFast to everyone. Well, Comcast says, no good. You can't come into the city and start deploying GFast. You have to deploy it everywhere. And unless you can deploy it everywhere, we can't trust that you're going to help bridge the digital divide, and therefore we're going to petition to stop your rollout. Now, that's not an isolated incident. They've used that in other places. They used it in D.C. They used it in Chicago. They used it in Colorado, all to stop CenturyLink deployments. So the fact that they're actually increasing the digital divide by keeping out a potential service to those underserved communities, it just speaks of horrible, horrible, horrible PR buzzwords. And then there's this. You may have, if you've been listening to the news, know that FCC Chairman Chief Tom Wheeler fired a shot across the bow of the ISPs with a public declaration that the U.S. market for broadband internet is not competitive enough. He struck at the oft-cited by ISP lobbyist statistic that 75% of Americans can choose between two or three ISPs for broadband connectivity. What he said was that DSL that delivers 4 megabits per second does not count. That's not broadband. And in fact, if you'd use that as your criteria, that 55% of U.S. households have one option for high-speed broadband and 20% have none. Now, all of this was to tell Comcast that that they're PR buzzwords, that they serve the community, that they provide great options for all these marginalized folk was just a lie. Well, of course, Comcast fired back. Immediately after Tom Wheeler came out, Cohen, who, again, remember, he's the one who gave money to Rahm Emanuel. He's the same guy who's their major lobbyist. He came out with all the regular buzzwords. He said Comcast wasn't going to take Wheeler's remarks sitting down. Within hours, they answered saying, look, this is going to be good for the industry. This will allow us to deploy infrastructure more rapidly. This will give consumers more choices. This will allow us to offer better services. In fact, he said a breathtakingly ironic statement. He said, look, this isn't going to stop competition because we don't compete with Time Warner. It's almost, folks, bafflingly ridiculous how unaware they are of what the people want. Comcast is essentially saying, look, we agreed with Time Warner long ago that we're not going to serve the market, same markets. We're not going to be in the same cities. We're not going to go head-to-head, which means that it's okay for us to join because, well, no customers can be served by Comcast and Time Warner at the same time. That's exactly the point that we've been trying to make about net neutrality, about competition, about ISPs not serving the public trust. The fact that they don't compete against each other, that they're major competitors who for some reason don't compete in a single market. The fact that they're trying to keep out potential competitors like CenturyLink. The fact that they are doing nothing but repeating the same PR statements and the tired social media memes that are trying to convince people that no, this is good, government is bad, just tells me that maybe they think we're not going to notice. And the scary thing is, they might be right. Now, folks, I'm sorry for that rant. I get kind of, well, you know, kind of crazy when we talk about ISPs. But luckily, there's a woman here who's going to bring some sense to the madness. She is a longtime twit. She is the woman of all tech. She is a maven of things that are wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my absolute pleasure and honor to present to you Miss Becky Worley. My goodness.
Wow.
Becky,
what an intro. I mean, where do I go from that? I mean, just throw the mic down. I'm out.
That absolutely deserved. Absolutely deserved. I mean, you were at Twit way before I was here. And just to see the work that you've been doing over the past couple of years, it's kind of amazing. It's interesting to see. I won't say local girl makes good, but I will say island girl makes good.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot we have all the connections. Yeah, no, it's I miss Twit so much. I loved being on Tech News Today, and I love doing This Week in Tech. And I realized that that was something that I was going to have to put on hold if I wanted to make a living in my other jobs and, oh, yeah, be a mom to twins. So I miss you guys, but I'm thrilled to be here with you, Padre, and seeing you doing so well. This is great. Twit, how's that been for you? What's life like podcasting? How different is that from what you ever imagined you'd be doing?
Believe it or not, the podcasting is not a whole lot different than preaching.
I believe that.
It's very much the same. It's a lot of passion. It's a lot of fun. You know this. I mean, I'm sure that you've experienced this, but there are some days I wake up and I think, they're paying me for this?
I just had that experience this week. I got to do a story. It was for Yahoo Tech. And I mostly work for Yahoo Tech and for Good Morning America now. Those are the main places where I get to make TV, which is, you know, so much fun. And to be creative and have a place where you can be creative is so fun. And I had a story that we did. It'll come out, I think, Tuesday, about battery chargers for the zombie apocalypse. And we went out into the woods and we shot it all kind of Blair Witch Project. And it was all about these different battery chargers. And there are just some days when you're like, the product you make is just burning a hole in your pocket. You want to show somebody. And those are the good days. And those keep you going for sure.
That's so the truth of trying to be, the tech person, the tech reporter, the tech specialist, the tech expert in a mainstream network or in a mainstream world. I mean, here in Twit, I'm the first to admit we're very isolated. I mean, we're a niche area. I love what I'm doing. I love reporting on tech things. But, you know, you step out of it and there's a lot of people who still look at tech people and they go, What do you do? I don't understand. Why do I care about what it is? How do you convey that sort of passion that say, look, this is something you should probably pay attention to?
Well, you know, you've made yet another parallel to preaching. You get to preach to the converted. And when you're out in the mainstream media talking tech, you know, you really have to figure out how you want to talk about it. And, you know, my job has changed so much. I still do pretty mainstream tech for Yahoo Tech, but for GMA, you know, I do. Technology has become a consumer issue. It's not just, you know, in its own little bubble and siloed. Technology is consumer reporting these days. It used to be that consumer reporting was crib recalls and cheap gas for summer road trips. Well, now consumer reporting is, you know, the story I have on GMA tomorrow, which is, you know, what to do with your old iPhone, how to repurpose it and keep using it. And then so not only is that kind of, you know, you have to really just treat it the way you would any other consumer issue. And then GMA sort of converted me into a straight consumer reporter. So I'm doing as many stories about, you know, jeans. And I did a story last week about, can you cook a steak from frozen based on, you know, one of the something I saw online from Cooks Illustrated. So I'm doing as much cooking, parenting, fashion, beauty, tech. It's all become the same thing. And I think that's really what's happened in a way as technology and the components of technology have become more commoditized. And you just sort of buy them the same way you buy a refrigerator. It's not the same as it was 15 years ago when I started as a tech reporter.
By the way, I did watch your segment on the jeans and how they're not different sizes. And I am convinced that that's why my pants always feel too small. It's the sizes were off.
They're messing with you. Probably. They want to suck you into a particular brand that you have loyalty around, and then you will only buy that brand. That is why the sizes are so different all over the map. This is investigative reporting.
The first time I heard that, I was like, no, that's silly. But then I started thinking about it. I'm like, actually, yeah. I mean, think about the psychological component there. If you're someone buying jeans, and let's say you're someone like me who's a little body image conscious, and I'm looking at it going, well, if I wear those, I'm a size 35, and if I wear these, I'm a size 40. Well, guess what? I'm wearing my skinny jeans.
Right? I know. Well, it's so interesting. I mean, and all these stories have a technology component now. That's the other thing that's so interesting. So that jeans story, that follows on the heels of a story I did a few months ago about all the new technologies they're trying to use to create better purchasing decisions around sizing and fit when you buy online. And so do you remember they had all these body scanners that were supposed to be the thing? People were going to go into the mall and they were going to get 3D body scanned and it was going to tell them exactly what their waist size was. And then they were going to know what their size should be. Well, the thing is, those have almost completely died because it's so uncomfortable to think about actually. I mean, it's like TSA combined with Mean Girls in high school. You know, you're in there like, what size am I? Oh God, everyone's going to know. I don't want to know. I don't want to see that picture. So that technology has completely not taken off, primarily because it just doesn't fit how we want to perceive ourselves. It's a UI issue, not a technology issue. So now what they're going to is this concept of using algorithms to figure out, well, we know that this many people return this brand and this style of Joe's jeans. So we know that those aren't true eights. So now that we know that that's actually a six, our algorithm is going to tell you, you should probably be a six in Joe's or a eight in this. And I just like this idea that now it's gone to something that's more humanistic and gone with algorithms over body scanning. Yeah. So interesting.
And you know, there's something here. Your job is so much harder than my job. Let me explain this. When I am talking on a show here on the Twit TV network, I can assume that my audience has a vocabulary, that they have a basic understanding of the technology that we're playing with, and that if I say something like IP address, it's not going to make them gloss over. You have to explain the same technologies, but you can't use any of that language.
Well, you know, I've come to a couple of different philosophies about TV and about talking about technology and consumer issues on TV. Video is 80% what you see. That's what you take in. That's your cognitive process and what actually resonates and you remember. I think that about 15% is what you see the people on TV experiencing emotionally. So emotion really resonates on TV. That's why reality television is so big, unfortunately. And then the last 5% is for information. And what's really fabulous as we kind of move into this next era of information is that people don't want details on TV. What they want is they want to be stimulated and just roughly educated so that if they want to go get more information, they immediately know where to go to get that. And that is not more television. That's what's so great about the sort of the nexus between television and the internet is it's perfect when you look at the cognitive process. We've got visual stimulation, emotional stimulation, and then you've got a place to actually fulfill those interests that are peaked, and that's the internet, and that's where you get the information. So I actually think it's gotten easier and easier for me. I just have fun on TV and try and make good pictures.
That's actually, it's a really good point. When we were getting all learned up in the seminary and they were giving us our homily classes, one of the things that they always told us was, look, it's about 60% how you look, it's about 30% how you sound, and it's about 10% what you say.
So, where'd you go to seminary?
Well, the Jesuits do it everywhere. So I was in, I started in Culver City. I was in Chicago. I was in Berkeley, UC Berkeley, to get my Master's of Divinity and Theology degree.
Holy Spirit Parish. That's my parish.
In Hawaii?
No, in Berkeley.
In Berkeley. Okay.
The Newman Center. Ooh. Yeah.
Because I've worked at two Holy Spirit parishes. Okay.
No, St. Teresa's on Maui and then Holy Spirit in Berkeley.
So I know St. Teresa's. That's a nice little parish.
Mom's the choir director, 28 years.
I will be doing a wedding there, I think, next summer.
Oh, my gosh. Hmm. Yeah, you'll have to tell her. I'll tell her you're coming. Don't worry. And Father Terry, he's the priest there. I'll let him know. You know, I was just down at St. Patrick's Seminary and was there for the installation of their new
bishop
head guy.
Oh, okay.
He's the guy who's in charge of all that. And it was just the craziest thing I've ever seen. He's like a second cousin of mine, and in the room with the incense everywhere and seven bishops and, oh my gosh, the high mass. I mean, do Catholics know how to put on a show or what?
We used to call it, it's the smells and bells, which, by the way, I'm allergic to incense. So when they pour it on, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a bad night.
Yes. It's like, see, when I was at Tech TV, just speaking of, I was thinking about you and the transition that you made, the digital Padre. I love that. I went to Wisconsin to do a story about the inkjet monks. This was a sect of Catholic priests who had decided that their calling was refilling empty inkjet cartridges. It was the most incredible thing I've ever experienced.
I remember that story.
They were so hardcore.
Well, I mean, I think weren't those the monks who, like, before they had been making fudge? Because that's typically, like, monks make fudge and cheese and wine. And then
I think they might have been Capuchins.
Oh, yeah, 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 exactly. And at some point someone said, wait a minute, we're making fudge and we're selling it for, like, $1 a pound. We could make inkjet cartridges and sell it for $10,000 a pound. Let's do that.
They did. And, I mean, they were really successful. I want to find out what happened to those guys. It was so fascinating.
They were acquired by Microsoft.
They actually.
There's a big outcry, but you know, all right.
Right.
Becky, I want to take it a little bit back because we've seen your work. Everyone in the audience right now, everyone listening to this on the download, has seen your work, and we know that you can speak. We know that you know how to present. We know that you know how to work all the angles to make people learn. But we want to know a little bit more about you. Let's talk about the shared heritage, because I know that you grew up in Hawaii. You're actually an island girl. Can you tell me a little bit about growing up in Maui? One of the experiences I had when I was living, because I actually lived on Oahu in Manoa. Mm. One of the experiences we had was everyone thinks Hawaii would be a great place to live. And then you actually live there and you realize, A, the cost of living is ridiculous. Ridiculously high. B, there are no jobs for young people, and especially no jobs if you don't want to be involved with the tourism industry. And C, you're on an island. So as beautiful as it is, you're still on an island and there's nowhere else you can go. I didn't go crazy because I loved the work, but as someone having grown up, did you always think I want to move away from the islands, or did you say this is where I'm going to spend the rest of my life?
Oh, I never thought I would live on the mainland, ever. I was like, no, Hawaii is it. That's where I'm going to stay. And it wasn't really until I kind of realized probably the most important point you made there, which is just how hard it is to make a living. And I don't mean the money. It's more, it's really hard to find a job that doesn't crush your spirit there. I don't really believe in the development. I don't think it's been good for Hawaii, all of the building and the hotels, more. I mean, some is good, but more is not better. And, you know, so development is pretty much one of the only things you can do that's really stimulating. The tourism industry is fun, but it's limited. And then, you know, the biggest employer in Hawaii is the electric company and the government. Mm-hmm. And that just wasn't what I wanted to do. And, you know, to be creative in Hawaii is really, really hard. And so that's just sort of, you know, when I was growing up, there was a fishing show every Sunday night at 5 o'clock called Let's Go Fishing with Harry Kojima. And this was my favorite show ever, appointment TV. And so I grew up wanting to have a fishing show. So in order to get a fishing show, you have to learn how to make TV. So when I graduated from college, I went and got a job at a TV station. Now, I never actually got that fishing show, but the one progression after another led me down the line with TV, and here I am. And I couldn't really imagine going back to Hawaii. And, you know, I have a friend from ABC. Her name's Yunji Denise, and she was covering the First Lady for ABC for many years. And then she decided to go back to Hawaii. She's from the Big Island, and she's anchoring the news on Channel 4 there. And it's like, you know, it's not optimal. It's not what she wanted to do, but she just really wanted to be back in Hawaii, and that was super important for her. So here I am. I'm covering tech here.
One of my co-hosts for This Week in Enterprise Tech, Brian Chi, he lives in Oahu. We knew each other before I moved to Hawaii, and after I moved away, I wanted him to be part of my show because he runs the world's largest independent testing lab on Oahu, which is a strange place to run a network testing lab. He's been involved in running communications links around the island. He's done a lot of work with the university, with the government to make sure that the islands are linked up. But, you know, he's in this weird spot where he was born on the islands. He wants to die on the islands. But at some point, he's like, I don't know if I'll be able to continue living here. I mean, it's so expensive to live. We could sell our house and live incredibly comfortably on the mainland. But do we want to do that?
Yeah, it's one of the most expensive places to retire. I know my parents are looking down that pathway right now. But, you know, it's the making a living there. I give my friends so much credit. They're all doing the hustle. They have 2 and 3 jobs. People who move from the mainland to Hawaii and think, oh, it's paradise. I can't wait to live there. Ooh, the attrition rate, the move back to the mainland sort of percentage is pretty high because it's, you know, really tough to make a living. You know, some of the interesting stats about Hawaii is that Maui's Costco has the highest percentage membership in the per capita folks who live there of any Costco in the country, because the margins are so thin when you live in Hawaii that you have to shop in bulk and be really creative around things. I mean, the cost of living is no joke. And then there's the social aspects. I mean, it is a closed island. It's a really long-lived social hierarchy that's been there for a really long time. And breaking in is not as easy as you would think. So I miss it. I go back a lot. I'm probably there 5 or 6 weeks a year. That's my real treat, you know, to be there. But I can't imagine trying to make a living there. I think I'll be like all the internet millionaires who go back there, all the Peter Thiels and the, you know, the folks who have their big houses there. And I think, let's see, Michael Dell has a house on the Big Island. Peter Thiel has an insane house in McKenna on Maui. A bunch of VCs. They do that Mai Tai event every year on Maui, where all the windsurfers and the kite surfers who are Silicon Valley folks go out there. So I think I'll just maybe try and just leech into that. But stay here on the mainland.
I think Zuckerberg has a place in Maui, and I believe Ellison bought a place near Kauai. Not on Kauai, but like one of the islands that we're not supposed to be able to be on near Kauai.
Well, see, no, I think he bought Lanai.
That's right.
Yeah, he bought the whole island. The Niihau, the one that's up by Kauai, I'd be interested to find out, because I bet there are a bunch of tech millionaires who've tried to make that play. But yeah, it's going to be so interesting to see what he does with Lanai. He's tried to do some alternative energy and renewable energy plays, but he's met with a little bit of resistance. But I think he could move the needle a little bit there. There's some interesting stuff he could do with his leverage and amazing force of will that is all Larry.
Well, I mean, if he offered something to the islands other than another tourist spot, I think they'd actually take it.
Yeah. No, that's what was so interesting. He was talking about taking the America's Cup to Oahu, which I think would be phenomenal. But
did you watch any of that when it was here in San Francisco?
I was so bummed. I was out of town for a lot of it. Did you get to see any of
it? I saw like five of the races.
And what did you think?
I thought I was going to be bored to tears. I thought, oh, it's a rich man's sport. It was amazing. It was so much fun. Essentially, you're watching 8-story buildings travel at 45 miles an hour across the bay. It was breathtaking, and it was so much fun. It was so exciting. I thought it's going to be boring looking at these boats through binoculars, but I still watch some of the races on replay on YouTube, and I go, this is an honest-to-goodness sport. I would totally watch this.
Okay, next time. You've sold me. I'm in.
There you go. All right. Now, let's talk a little about you coming into tech, because you've told us about growing up on the island, how you worked at a television station, and then you slowly transitioned into technology. Obviously you had some interest there, but what was it that dragged you in? Do you remember the story that said, this is the beat I want to have, this is where I think there's going to be meat, this is where I think I can make my mark?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think what that like seminal moment was. I guess I was working in TV in Seattle, and I was just really fascinated more by everything that was happening in technology than I was by any of the stories I was covering. And so I just have always been geeky. My dad's an engineer. And so, you know, I won the computer science prize in high school, just because I couldn't stand the sight of my own handwriting. So I learned how to use the mainframe to word process. I was always more interested in things with the computer than I was even in a lot of the TV jobs that I was doing. And then I moved back. I was living in Manoa. I was like, okay, I'm going to try and make it work at TV, you know, in Honolulu. And then I saw this job come up for this place called Tech TV. At the time, it was ZDTV. And I thought, gosh, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to do something in computers and technology. So I jumped at it, and I was Leo's first producer. And he worked on the site when he was Dev Null. But then when he got his own show, I was his producer. And our other producer got sick for another one of the shows he was hosting. He was hosting two shows there, Call for Help and Screensavers. So I jumped in and produced the other one for a while. And it was really an inmates running the asylum kind of place. These people had no experience doing a daily television show. And I'd luckily had that experience in Seattle. And so, you know, to work with Leo and just see how he could be so incredibly knowledgeable and so personable and so humanistic in the way that he approached technology was such an inspiration for me. And so he started wanting to take Fridays off, and I said, well, I'll try and switch over to the other side of the camera, which was excruciatingly painful at first. But as I said, it was the inmates running the asylum, and only about 17 people were watching. So that was the perfect opportunity.
I was one of them.
Yay. So he's always been a mentor for me. He wrote my recommendation letter to go to grad school. I got in. So, you know, he's always been an inspiration for me. And that's why I loved working at Twit when they started Tech News Today. It was just such an opportunity to host the show with Tom and with Sarah and, you know, to be around Jason when he came on. And I just loved getting to know Lisa through Leo. And so Twit feels like family to me. And it just, you know, it's it's always home. And it's such a good opportunity for me to just be in that community. It was really intimidating when I started. You know how it is when you're trying to kind of get your chops in technology. You always feel like there's somebody who knows more than you. And I had to work with Patrick Norton every day, who gave me the beatdown that, of course, he knew more than every human on the planet. Of course, he knew more than me. So having to, sort of sharpen your skills, hone your knowledge, get your confidence up to be able to talk back to Patrick Norton. Good morning, America. George Stephanopoulos, please.
That's actually a really nice way to look at it. Now, you spent 6 years at ZDNet and Tech TV. And so you saw the transition between ZDNet and Tech TV. Yeah. You weren't there for when some company came in and decided, I won't even, you know what, I can't, it's such a painful memory, I can't even talk about it. It was just, what happened to that network? Especially since it seemed to me, towards the end years there, Tech TV was really kind of finding its own. People were starting to hear about it. They were starting to realize this is the source to go to. And it was at the start of the boom, where people were realizing tech is really, really important. We should probably get on this thing, and here's a good source. That suddenly, I remember the announcement that now it's going to become part of a gaming network. And I'm thinking, what's going on here?
Yeah, it was really disappointing in the moment. I think you nailed it. We really peaked too soon. We were before our time. And if we could have just stayed under the radar for a little bit longer. But as you mentioned, Comcast came in and took over. And I think really what happened is Paul Allen, who owned Tech TV at the time, I think Paul Allen lost us in a poker game. It's not that far.
Can we put that on the record?
There's something weird that happened where he had a debt, and part of the repayment of the debt was to give all of the subscribers that Tech TV had. We had a lot of eyeballs in terms of we'd done a good job negotiating cable relationships with smaller cable carriers. And so Comcast, by acquiring all of those deals for subscriber outlets, they could put in their own network, and that would really boost their network. So they combined us. It became part of, G27, 4, 5, 6. And ultimately, I think we were a little too much too soon. It's really sad because it could have been something really cool. On the other hand, it was the greatest diaspora ever for all of us who worked there, because now all these really talented people who knew a lot about technology when other people in the business didn't know much, they just blew out to CNN and CBS and ABC and all the different magazines and blogs. And then we got to go kind of network. And that's, I've never, ever had an agent. I've never had, a recruiter or anything like that. Every job I've ever gotten has been from a friend from Tech TV.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about it that way, because in a way, Tech TV was the original San Francisco tech incubator. I mean, when you think of all the talent that exploded out of that place, you and Leo and Patrick Norton and Kevin Rose and Sarah Lane, Perillo, I mean, just go down the list of who's who in the tech world. And in some way, shape, or form.
And in the TV world, you've got Erica Hill, who's hosting on the Today Show. You've got Michaela Pereira, who's on CNN. You've got Sumi Das, who's on BBC. I mean, it is really cool that we did have a really interesting synergy between media and technology. And it created a sense, I think it really encapsulated some of the San Francisco tech scene way before there was one, when it was either in the Valley or San Francisco was sort of, just where, there wasn't a big tech scene happening there at the time. But it's so interesting the places people have gone from there.
Right. Drew Nielsen in the chat room says that it was sort of like the big bang of tech. And I think it was, it took the implosion of Tech TV to make what we have today, which I think it's great. I think actually, I only got to watch one in-studio episode of the Screensavers at the old Tech TV, and it was so much fun. And if you had told me that about 10 years later, I was going to be hosting a show on the spiritual successor to Tech TV, I wouldn't have believed you. Yeah. I think what you did was you made everything accessible.
Yeah, I have to give Leo so much credit for that because he really set the tone by making it about people first. And I think everybody recognized that he was, he was the real leader of that network, and he had an internal compass that almost everybody got behind. Other shows had different flavors, but he really led that. And that humanistic approach, again, I mean, I feel like I keep using that word because it just describes so well what he brought to the party and what he continues to do. And that's why, I mean, what he's done with TWiT is so cool, to have taken that compass that he has had for so long and just keep rolling with it and bring it into its own in an entrepreneurial way. I just have so much pride in him for that.
Yeah, I think... that is, in a nutshell, the thing that I like working at TWiT most about. Because, I mean, in my situation, I don't need to make a living. I don't need a big contract. I mean, I have a different kind of alternative lifestyle. But I like being part of something that, and you've been a part of this, you've experienced it before I did, that is kind of, it's a disruptive force in what we know as media. And that's just cool. That's just fun.
Well, and, you know, you always have... CYO basketball coaching that you can fall back on. So, I mean,
are you kidding? I'm a Jesuit. If I get fired from TWiT the next day, I'm teaching at a university. That's just how it works. It's not even an alternative thing. It's just, oh, you don't work there anymore? Yeah, there we go. Now, let's talk a little bit about, because you, beyond Tech TV, beyond ZDNet, beyond your degree in you took a BA in the arts, and then you took a master's degree in education and technology at Stanford?
Yeah, it was such an interesting program. It was called Learning, Design, and Technology, and it was through the School of Education in conjunction with the Computer Science Department. And it was a real focus on creating learning environments basically, how to teach educators enough computer science that they could create learning environments for the next wave of digital education. And I completely hacked that and did my own thing with it. I basically wanted to take half education classes and half computer science classes so that I could figure out how to better teach computer science through video. And they thought that was a little weird, but this was the best place they could put me. And it was fascinating to do that at the time. I think what I learned a lot about was about user interface and how important it is. And then just human-computer interface as the fundamental principle, and that has always helped to guide me in every story I've ever done about technology. It takes a lot of the zeros and ones out of it and just makes it more personal and more experiential. And so that was really a confidence builder for me to do that work. And I just really enjoyed it, and to be in that environment at the time in conjunction with Tech TV, I sort of got the, you have to have a lot of confidence to be out on camera, and you got to find your armor any way you can. And so to be amongst those folks and taking Introduction to Programming, with all those undergrads at Stanford, oh my God, it nearly killed me, but I did it, and nobody can ever take that away from me. So that degree was totally worth it. And at the same time, to be working at Tech TV and coming across amazing people. I mean, I was looking back at a story I did. It was called Pack Manhattan. And it was about these kids at NYU who were grad students in computer science, and they were creating a game of Pac-Man in the streets around NYU. And they had cell phones and GPS locators, and they had controllers up in the main building, and then they had four ghosts, Inky, Blinky, and whatever the other two are. Whatever. They were actually in the pastel cutout little sheets, running around the streets that were the grid on cell phones with their handlers. And then you had Pac-Man running around trying to escape them. And if they tagged them, they'd be out. Now, the reason why I tell you this story is that one of the kids was Dennis Crowley, who eventually started Foursquare. I didn't realize it until I was looking back at some old video, and I'm like, that's Dennis Crowley. He was just a grad student at the time. And it was just so cool to go back and think of all the interesting people that we met during that time, and to have had that experience at Stanford too was pretty cool. And I just feel really lucky to have had that.
You've been involved with a lot of the right crowds, it would seem. You've just been, there's too much coincidence for this to be coincidence.
I've definitely been lucky, and to be interested in technology in the 90s and the early 2000s, and to be interested in television worked out to be so fortuitous and lucky.
Let me talk about something. This was actually asked by JJ to the 488, 48th, 8th, whatever. I'm not sure. He has a weird chat room name. But he's asking about how you feel about women in the field of technology. And this is actually an important topic, because you are a very high profile woman. You're incredibly intelligent. You've been very successful. You've had twins, and you've managed to do all of this in spite of the fact that, let's be honest here, our industry is not really fair to women. How was that? I mean, do you see yourself as, well, of course you don't see yourself as a beacon, but I know other people see you as, that's a model of how you do it.
So funny. I don't think of myself as a model at all, because I see myself more as a TV person than, I mean, I have so much respect for people who are engineers and computer scientists and programmers. I mean, one of my best friends, she has a math degree from Stanford, and she went to go to work at this company where they were creating all these incredible algorithms. And she always likes to say she models for a living. She creates mathematical models. But she was working in this all dude company. She has a kid. You know, it's all the stuff that you're not, she has to, deal with all this junk where they didn't give her any maternity leave and they didn't let her breastfeed there. I mean, all the stupid stuff. And she's working in an all-dude company. That's sort of one of those anecdotal things where you're like, come on, guys, can we do a little better here? But, I think the interesting thing for me is there's so much pressure and concept around this story around, getting women to take engineering, science, STEM classes. And I think that really has, that message has gotten into the classrooms. And I hope that that just becomes more institutionalized, and it's going to take a while, but it's just not that simple. I mean, I have a boy and a girl, and, a geeky, athletic mom. And, we don't have a lot of gender roles in this house. And my kids are so hardwired, boy and girl. I mean, she likes pink, he likes orange and blue. He likes sports, she likes dolls. We got the Goldilocks for her. She didn't want anything to do with them. Do they play Legos together? Kind of. She'll read the instructions to him while he does it. He'll jump over and, they interact with each other, and anything, sky's the limit for them. But I mean, when you have a control group like this, I kind of feel like there's certain things that it's just going to take a lot of time to just work through. And I wish that I knew more about what the causes and roots are of the issue of so few women in technology. But that's something I'd like to learn more about and really do the research myself, because I feel like it's so talked about, but nobody really knows what the issue or the answer is.
Right, right. I think it's one of those things where, and I've been at conferences where a spontaneous discussion about this will break out. And you kind of look around the room and you go, there is something wrong. I mean, looking at the demographic of who we've got here, there are way more women who are interested in tech that are represented in this room. There are way more women who are experts in this field than are represented in this room. And yet no one can put a finger on why aren't there more of those women in this room.
It just takes time, I think. I mean, my dad was a quality control engineer for Smith Corona typewriters. I mean, if there isn't a previous generation of computer geek, it's a typewriter geek, right? Like, I'm straight from the tree, the apple is falling. But there were no chicks that were working there. I mean, so it's better. It's not good enough. It'll get better. It's great that we're having the conversation. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I think that's probably the best answer. When people say, I don't know, that always opens it up to a further discussion. I like that. I was talking to someone else who, at the same conference, and this topic came up, and I was like, well, I don't know what's going on. And she says, let me tell you what's going on. It's the patriarchal male society that tells women that they're no good. And I'm thinking, I'm not feeling that right now, but maybe I'm just not seeing it. I know that there's definitely patriarchal issues here. I don't think that's an easy thing that you're talking about. It's probably right. A bit more complicated than that, but a good start.
Yeah. I think it is, you know, it's a snowball effect because, you know, I think as more and more girls get interested in science, technology, education type opportunities, their friends will want to do what they do. It's total snowball. And, I mean, there's definitely a feminist look at this problem, and there is a different way of going about science and technology, the way that men talk about things. I mean, I go back to that experience I had with Pat and all the guys at Tech TV, Jim Lauterbach. It was a fun clash of the titans for them to go head to head about, you know, which I can't even remember some of the things we would fight about. I mean, yeah, RAID versus blah, 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 hard drive storage, you know. These would be like massive cage matches that went down. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? These guys are like going for blood here. It's just not the way that I would want to do that. Maybe that was just that fun kind of crazy, intense crowd back in that day. But there was something about the culture that was not conducive to women in the way that we normally interact around things.
I think so. And of course, our chat room being a product of society and a product of tech, they've immediately gone to a discussion of women versus men, especially how women can bear children and therefore blah, 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 blah. But sometimes it's nice to be able to count on chat room to do things.
Well, you know, there's also the other question of which, you know, you always have to answer when you're talking about women in the workplaces, which is you can't have it all. You can't be all things to all people, including your children. You have to turn the dials down somewhere. I mean, this is sort of what I experienced when I was trying to, you know, my kids were like 2.5 or 3 years old. I was working for GMA. I was working for Yahoo. I was trying to host Tech News Today with Tom every day. It's like, you don't have infinite capacity. You have to make choices at a certain point. And I want to put my kids first. That's what I want to do. That brings me joy, satisfaction, and a sense of accomplishment more than anything else. And, you know, I'm really lucky. I have a partner who really, you know, we both get that. And we want to do this in a way that we're all in for our kids because they're only going to be little once, you know, and we don't do any of the real like working, non-working. And I think that makes life so much easier. But you still don't have infinite capacity and you have to make choices. And I'm choosing my kids.
Right, right. And it's, I don't know. There's something about that. I know that people will get upset by it. When you say, I'm choosing my kids, there's always going to be those people who say, well, why does she have to choose her kids? You know, why is she in that position? Why does she have to be the woman, the mother, the person who takes care of kids? And, you know, that's actually a good question. I'm not going to denigrate that. I'm not going to make fun of it.
You know, and I think this is a perfect opportunity to answer that. You know, my partner is a woman and we both want to be in the workplace and we both want to be parents. And so we both have dialed it back a little bit and we share those responsibilities in a way that it works for us, but neither one of us can have it all. Neither one of us can be on the A team for every job thing that's happening. You know, you have to make choices. You do not have infinite capacity and you don't have infinite time with your kids. So I feel like the balance issue is accepting there is no balance, accepting you can't have it all and being perfectly happy with that.
I spent 2 weeks on a mountaintop in Bolivia with a Buddhist monk who he had a line that I use every once in a while. On special occasions, I'll break it out in a homily where he said, you become an adult when you reach that point in your life that there's more of your life behind you than there is ahead of you. When you realize that your energy is no longer boundless, that your options are no longer limitless. And when you realize you must choose what's important to you. And you know, I think that's just it's a really healthy way to look at life. And I think that's what you did. You said, look, I don't have to do this. This is not put on me. I choose because I want my kids to have this kind of experience. And I think that's adult and it's very healthy.
And it's not selfless because it makes me happier. You know, you ultimately have to choose the things that make you happier. I was just reading this book by a guy that I work with at ABC named Dan Harris. It's called 10% Happier. And he talks about how he went all in working at ABC and was so competitive with David Muir and with Bill Weir. And he was trying to get Peter Jennings' attention and just be the golden child. And he completely crashed and burned. And he started having panic attacks on air, and he couldn't keep it together because he was so unbalanced and all in and trying to have it all. And you just don't have infinite capacity. And so you have to choose the things that ultimately make you happier. And it's funny because he went on this real spiritual quest to figure out what it was going to be. And I recommend the read to anyone. It was really interesting. It's kind of a layman's introduction to meditation and Buddhism. And he was ABC's religion reporter for a long time. So he was exposed to, you know, all kinds of things all across the spectrum. And so it was really fun for him to sort of do a survey course in religion and come to Buddhism. And, you know, I'm definitely a smorgasbord Catholic. I pick and choose from a lot of different religions and just happen to practice often in the Catholic Church. But I definitely feel like there's a humility of just accepting your limitations that comes with happiness.
I think I'm more of a buffet Catholic. I put way too much on my plate, and now I'm just sitting there going, oh.
I can't eat it all.
Not another bite. Becky Worley, I want to thank you so very much for coming on Padres Corner. This was a blast. This was exactly what I was hoping it would be, just a chance to talk to you and you know, shoot the breeze. You've got such a history, especially with the company that I'm working with right now, that even just a tiny bit of your historic knowledge is a pleasure to have. So again, thank you for coming on Padres Corner.
Oh, I so enjoyed it. And I've really been looking forward to getting to know you a little bit better, Padre. I love what you're doing and I love Twit. So thank you so much for having me. And I just miss the Twit Army so much. So it's just a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, maybe we'll have the Twit Army come visit you in Hawaii. At Larry Ellison's new place, right?
Ding.
This is Larry, if you're listening, we'd like to go to your new place. And could we sail there on one of your AC-72s? That would be fantastic. That would be awesome.
I'll get to work on that right away.
Oh, Becky, if you could please tell the folk, I mean, of course, they're going to know most of this already, but where can they find you? If they want to find your work, if they want to find what you've been doing, if they want to find who you've been working with, where should they go?
Probably best bet is Twitter. I'm at B Worley on Twitter. And, you know, I post pretty regularly what I'm doing. Yahoo Tech is really where I'm doing a lot of the tech work that I'm doing, working with David Pogue, he has a lot of that spirit that Leo brings to technology. And I really love working with him and learning from him. And also Rafe Needleman, who is at CNET, and my longtime producer, Brad Marshland, who I adore. So I'm working with them at Yahoo Tech, publishing regularly. Battery Chargers for the Zombie Apocalypse will be coming out next week. Check it out. tech.yahoo.com. And then Good Morning America. I'll be on tomorrow talking about ways to recycle your cell phone. And next week, I will be discussing all the new services that bring you dinner ready to cook in a box, like Blue Apron, Plated, HelloFresh. Oh my gosh, that was one of the funnest stories to do. I get to cook and cover technology at the same time. I'm so lucky.
Well, there you have it. If you can't find Becky Worley, you're probably not looking hard enough. To turn on the TV, open up a browser, go to Yahoo, go to Good Morning America, you'll find her. Again, Becky, it's been a pleasure. This will not be the last time you're on Padres Corner. You know, the first time I have a guest on, I always like talking about their life, their story. But next time, let's geek out. Let's go over some of the tech.
I like it.
All right. I'll see you next time. Ladies and gentlemen, say goodbye, Miss Becky Worley. That's right. She's the one with the tech. Now, folks, I want to thank you for joining me here for Padres Corner. It is always a lot of fun, especially when we've got the Twit Army coming out in Mass Live to watch us in studio. We make this podcast available for the download. Just go to twit.tv Padre. You'll be able to get all of our previous episodes, including the one with Lance Haskell, where we talked about anime, or talk about beer with Mary Jo Foley, or maybe even talking about Stargate sci-fi with David Hewitt. And if you take a look here, we've got a little drop-down menu that lets you get the version of choice into your device of choice. Do you want it in your iPhone? We could do that. Do you want it in your brand new iPad? We could do that too. Do you want a video version in your laptop and a high definition version for streaming to your Roku? We can do that because we love you. Now, we do this show live every Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. Go ahead and join us live. You'll see the pre-show, the post-show, and all the bloopers that get cut out of the edit. And as long as you're going to watch us live, why not join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, where you'll be able to talk to some brilliant folks, some bright engineers, and some funny trolls. It's all part of the experience, the experiment that is Twit TV. Also, follow me on Twitter. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll be able to see what I do in between shows at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. You'll see me prep for the various shows I do here on Twit, including This Week in Enterprise Tech on Mondays at 2:30, or Know How, where I'm going to be doing maker projects at 11 o'clock a.m. on Thursdays, or maybe even Coding 101, where me and Shannon Morse will be breaking down the lives of the code monkeys for everyone in the Twit army. Also, don't forget that you can find us here at twit.tv, all of the shows on the Twit TV network. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible, to Lisa and Leo for leaving the lights on, and especially to my guest, Vicky Worley. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, and until next time, geek out.